Yes, I'd like to thank Michelle and the other organizers for inviting me here to this wonderful meeting. And I enjoyed all the talks here. And thank you for staying till the very end. So my talk is actually more of a proposal. That's why, I put a question mark there. It's more of a proposal. It's not something that has been carried out. And so I'd like to discuss this numerical link cluster spectroscopy of quantum spin ice. I've had a number of collaborators, many of whom are present here at this meeting, but I think some of the key ideas I'll talk about were discussed really with Michelle. So Michelle also asked me as the final speaker to give a summary, add a couple of slides of summary for the talk, for the conference really. So I just, as probably one of the most singularly unqualified persons really to do this, I made a list of just 2 pages of things summarizing what I saw as the big things to come out of this meeting. So first of all, rare earth pyroclose, let me start with the materials aspects. So rare earth pyroclose provide an enormous variety and flexibility, but that comes at the cost of various forms of disorder and soft modes. So how does that affect properties? I mean, that's not fully really taken into account. It can, most interesting part of it, of course, in my view, is that it can often enhance quantum effects and make things more interesting. The effective quantum spin degrees of freedom really are originating from high spin plus spin orbit plus crystal field effects. And the theory that Jeff presented is very beautiful about that. That can lead to rather unusual, the most interesting one I thought was these dipolar, octopolar objects whose coupling to magnetic fields and neutrons can be rather esoteric. Symmetry analysis is very elegant, but often symmetries are perturbed very often very badly. What does it do is not often taken into account. We mostly, people talk about dipolar and exchange quantum spin ice, and we had various talks suggesting that they have very different time scales and local spectral features. But perhaps there are other kinds of couplings which are also important, such as quadrupolar couplings. Often, this one point I found quite interesting is that often the spectral features, interesting spectral features set in at temperatures of order J. Pinch points, monopoles, even Dirac strings, we got evidence today, could set in at a relatively high temperature. Quantum spin ice is, of course, the U1 variety is the one that we, most of us, really like and is defined by fractionalization, by these electric and magnetic spin-ons and photons. And we had really beautiful pictures by Dr. Matsuda of what these things actually are. They potentially can be seen in transport properties, such as thermal transport, in neutron spectra, in heat capacity. And actually, in many ways, these are much more perhaps characteristic than a plateau in the entropy, which I didn't really see much in the experiments. So, and many of these could even coexist with magnetic order. So one part which is very clear from the experiments is that these systems have an extremely rich phase diagram. There is a proximity to many ordered phases. There's reentrance. There's a very nice concept of fragmentation, which is a kind of a phenomenology involving different degrees of freedom. Some may become more like spin liquids. Others may order. There are many types of spin liquids. Pinch points may exist outside of the classical spin ice regime. Chemical pressure, disorder, pressure, magnetic fields, all of these can cause various kinds of phase transitions. I mean, that's really quite clear. In fact, I think more generally, that's the impression that I got, that one shouldn't really be just focused on quantum spin ice. Really, this is about quantum spin liquids with strong quantum effects. And there are all kinds of beautiful physics there. Multi-magnons versus spin-ons. I mean, can one reconcile these 2 pictures? Can one actually even connect them? As we saw in Radu's talk, one can basically, starting from strong fields, really see how these multi-magnons start condensing and becoming something else. Well, the last point here then brings me more to my talk, which is really how well do we know the exchange constants or the Hamiltonian for these materials? Okay, so the outline for my talk is really as follows. It's basically going to be about linked cluster methods. So I'd very briefly discuss what they are based on real space graphs. How are what are called series expansions related to numerical linked cluster expansions. And mostly they can be used for studying thermodynamic and static properties, but sometimes one could also calculate some dynamical properties. Application to quantum spin ice models. So how does one go from a Hamiltonian to thermodynamic properties? Where is it valid and where it is not valid, really? So scope and limitations. And this final point is really more of a question mark. I mean, can it really guide us to actually determining the exchange constants? So some kind of a spectroscopy aided by NLC. OK, so the whole class of methods, one could call them, which are being called linked cluster methods, they're really based on real space graphs. They're formally defined in the thermodynamic limit. So if we consider an extensive property, which is the simplest to illustrate, really, such as the heat capacity or entropy or susceptibility in the thermodynamic limit, can be expressed really as a sum of all clusters that can be embedded in the lattice times a sum of two properties. First is called the lattice constant, which is just a count of how many ways that cluster can be embedded in the lattice. And in a translationally invariant system, these counts are simply proportional to the number of lattice sites, because you can translate them anywhere. That's why this factor of n drops out, which is the number of sites. So that only depends on the lattice. And the second factor, called the weight of the cluster, only depends on the property on the finite cluster and its subclusters. So really, it's defined by this property of this particular property that if I want to know what a property on a particular cluster is, it can be expressed as a sum over all subclusters embedded in that cluster, this weight of that cluster. So this is known as the property of inclusion and exclusion. And what it means is that if I want to know what the weight is, all I need to know is how to calculate the property of the finite cluster and all its subclusters. Then by subtracting these things off, one is left with what is new provided by that cluster, what is not already accounted for by all the subclusters. So just as an example, high temperature series expansions are known to everyone from statistical mechanics. So basically, an extensive property can be expanded in powers of beta. And what this is one method of calculating the high temperature expansion. Basically, if we know how to expand say the entropy, for example, of a finite cluster as a power series, then this method will allow us to calculate the weight of a cluster. And since it subtracts off all the the weights associated with all the smaller clusters, this will only get contribution left over where every bond of that cluster is being used. So the lowest power in which it will contribute will be beta to the power L if there are L bonds. And that means that if we sum over all graphs with up to L bonds of this object over here, the remainder will be order beta to the power L plus 1. So in the thermodynamic limit, we will know the expansion to this particular order. OK, in a very similar way, one could also imagine doing a high field series expansion, which is not often done, but it can be done, where let's say H naught is a single site Hamiltonian, and I lump all the exchange parts into this part H1. And really, one can formally expand at any arbitrary temperature, really, as a function of this quantity lambda. And once again, one can develop a linked cluster method, whereby going up to certain size clusters, one can get the answer. The exact answer up to this certain power of this lambda. OK, so but most of the time we are interested in problems where there is no small parameter, and then how do we handle such a situation? So basically, we know that exact diagonalization is always valid, and that really remains the mainstay of computational quantum many-body systems. So can we combine these linked cluster methods to obtain answers in the thermodynamic limit? And that's basically what a numerical linked cluster method is. So we use essentially this scheme whereby formally one is working in the thermodynamic limit. The quantities are expressed as a sum over finite clusters of these counts and the weights. The counts do not depend on what kind of calculation you're trying to do. And the weights are defined in this way. And we basically, all we need to know somehow is to evaluate this quantity, P of C. From there, one can get the weights. And you obtain these quantities essentially by exact diagonalization, for example, one temperature, one magnetic field at a time. And so if we really sum over all of these, then the remainder that will be there basically will be order beta to the L plus 1 or 1 over H to the L plus 1. So clearly, if one is at a high temperature or high enough magnetic field, this will basically give us the exact answer. It's not clear how well it will work in this most interesting regime, of course, of low temperature and low magnetic field. So will it converge beyond the radius of convergence? In principle, yes, and often it converges beyond the radius of convergence, but not necessarily up to low temperatures and low fields. Okay, so then a secondary kind of question really is, how does one organize what the clusters are? Well, when one is doing a power series expansion, the interest really is to maximize the number of coefficient. So for example, when one is doing what are called high temperature expansion, then one uses these weak embeddings where the count is based on how many bonds there are in the cluster. But when one is doing, for example, a low temperature expansion of the Ising model, then one instead uses a strong embedding, which is based on the count, by where the count is organized by the number of sites. And there's slight differences. For example, such a graph will not be present when you count by sites, because if two sites are neighbor, you always have to draw a bond between them. That's why it's called a strong embedding. But here, we are really not interested in any particular power series. So what kind of count do we want? I mean, our goal really is to maximize the parameter regimes of convergence. So what we have found basically is that it is useful to organize by larger units, such as a square-based expansion or a triangle-based expansion or tetrahedra-based expansion. And that will, first of all, that completely reduces the count. So for example, on a Kagome lattice, up to, say, 15 sites, at the 15 site order, there are that many different topological clusters really that one has to consider, whereas 15 site corresponds to something like seven triangles basically. There are basically only about seven clusters that one has to consider. Actually, if one could do rectangular boxes, that is in some ways even better. Here is what happens if we do this for, say, the Kagome lattice Heisenberg model. This is a temperature here, this is heat capacity, and this is the uniform susceptibility. And one can see that this is the high temperature expansions basically converge up to this point. So this is the radius of convergence of the high temperature expansion. Pade approximants can be used to go further, but it's not clear how far they converge. There's no real way of knowing it. Whereas if we do this numerical link cluster expansion of 7 and 8 triangle, we see that they're converging up to here. And we believe one can use extrapolation methods on those, which we believe gives us a correct answer up to down to some, more or less it's about a factor of 5 or larger in the temperature regime where they are actually valid. The real advantage of using rectangular boxes is that one can then needs to do much fewer number of clusters, and perhaps one can even interface it with DMRG and QMC methods. Okay, so mostly one can calculate static properties. Static structure factors are okay, but dynamics, usually it doesn't work. I mean, if you really want to calculate dynamics, but one can certainly calculate frequency moments. And there was a recent work we did with Takashi Imai and one of my students, really, where we were looking at the Kagome lattice nuclear relaxation rates. And basically, we could calculate several frequency moments and then reconstruct from the frequency moments the spectral function and the compare with the 1 over T1 that was being measured. So let's get back to now the the pyrochlore lattice. So basically here we are interested in doing a tetrahedra-based expansion. That is the most natural. If we consider the classical spin ice, for example, Ising model on a pyrochlore lattice, then the single tetrahedron NLC is equivalent to the Pauling approximation. So for example, the entropy specific heat, one would get exactly the Pauling result all the way down to zero temperature. And one can see here that, you know, the high temperature expansions, whether you do Pardee approximant or D-log Pardee approximant, they start actually going wrong up at fairly high temperatures, whereas NLC with one tetrahedra and six tetrahedra is practically indistinguishable, really. I mean, that's really very accurate for this particular case. But of course, we are interested in the quantum model, and we heard a discussion of these models before. One can define them in terms of these parameters. And this was a calculation that we did some years ago with the Ross et al. Parameters, the neutron parameters taken from neutron scattering, basically, and we calculated the heat capacity. And this is what happens in a quantum model. So basically, up to four tetrahedra, which is what we were able to do, essentially the results converge up to the peak, and then they start to diverge. And we can use some extrapolation methods to really push them down a little bit, down to maybe of order one, about, this is about 2 Kelvin up to about 1 Kelvin, but not much lower than that. Okay, so that's roughly where it works. So now I want to get to this inverse problem. How do we, can we get from data to Hamiltonian? Well, before I discuss that, perhaps it's interesting to note that even the neutron scattering can be fit by multiple parameters. And we heard these in the talks. I just went back and looked at this paper by Robert et al. And clearly, you know, the data of Ross et al. Is rather well fit by other sets of exchange parameters as well, which is what they showed. And we heard in Radu's talk that he has many more directions in the in magnetic field, and much more data is better fit by a new set of exchange constants, where really the most amazing thing to me is that JZZ is no longer the dominant exchange constant. So I don't believe, I mean, the suggestions from Michel, which is what this talk is really based on, is not that we replace the neutron scattering method for getting the exchange constant. That is always going to be the much more accurate method. But can we have a quick and dirty way of, from the heat capacity itself, have a way of getting to the exchange constants and getting an idea of what kind of parameter regime is the material in. As soon as it is synthesized, can from the heat capacity measurement itself, can we get an idea of what kind of exchange parameters we are talking about? Okay, so so one thing that we are all, of course, familiar with is that one often uses the inverse susceptibility, this Curie-Weiss fit, to get the Curie-Weiss constant. One should keep in mind that really this is always an effective fit, and one cannot do something like, you know, fit various terms in the high temperature expansion, because that will require rather accurate data and very high temperatures. But this fit is usually robust over a large range of temperature. But one has to keep in mind that if you try to locally fit it to a straight line and get the intercept, that is called the effective Curie-Weiss constant, which was defined by Michael Fisher and one of his collaborators, you know, maybe 30 years ago. One can see that above 10 times this scale J, one can maybe get it to about a 10% accuracy. But if you are not at that high a temperature, then really you're getting it, the Curie-Weiss constant, roughly to within factors of 2. Okay, can one get more than one exchange constant? So here's a work that actually Radu and I were involved in. If you have this, for example, this J1, J2 model on a triangular lattice, Can we get the ratio of J2 over J1, for example, from, say, the susceptibility measurement? So what we did was, if you scale out the peak, if you can get to the peak, then you can scale out the temperature by the scale, by this peak value, and the susceptibility by the peak value, and you can get various dimensionless parameters. And basically what we found is that different materials really fit quite well with different values of J1 over J1 plus J2. So one could not only get the overall exchange scale, but also the ratio of J1 is to J2 by this technique. Now, of course, in an anisotropic system, really one cannot separate out the J's from the G's, really. So one would be effectively dealing with a six exchange constant system. That would be very difficult, really. So what can we get simply based on heat capacity? Now, one thing, I don't have much data actually on the system of quantum spin I system of interest, but let me just, this was a work that I was working with Jan Oitma on recently. If we just look at the Kitaev-Heisenberg model on the honeycomb lattice, so let's imagine that you just have two parameters. J is one, and K, which is the Kitaev parameter, is another one. What is very interesting is that the moment you go into the Kitaev regime, the magnitude of the heat capacity is much smaller. You clearly, where the peak is, of course, depends on what your J and larger energy scales are. But if you look at the magnitude of the specific heat peak, it immediately tells you whether the material is mostly dominated by the Kitaev term or the Heisenberg term. So if we had something like that, of course, that would be quite nice. So is the zero field heat capacity really discriminating enough to tell us something about the exchange parameters? I mean, it certainly gives us the overall energy scale. So there is a peak value of the specific heat, there's a peak temperature, and there's a shape to it. I don't have a numerical calculation to really say whether how much variation there is in this model. I mean, the way Radu presented the physical interpretation of the coupling, one of the largest term was actually the Kitaev term. So it's possible that looked at it in that language, there will be a separation in the magnitude or shape of the short range heat capacity peak. But I don't know. I have not seen the numerical data, really. One cannot, again, in my view, focus too much on the exact details of the peak, because we could try to sort of match the move the J's around so as to match with the experiment better. But that clearly is not appropriate, because, you know, so here I was earlier showing this data which corresponded to this Blotet et al. But here is two other sets of data, and you can see that they are not exactly the same. So there's clearly variations from sample to sample. So anything one wants to do must be based on really really crude features.
Actually, at these temperatures, it might be how well they've subtracted off the...
Yeah, so that one, that's exactly right. So one can't really literally fit it. You know, one has to worry about the crude features. Can one go beyond the peak? Well, so where does the high temperature limit set in? So if at high temperatures it has to fall off as 1 over T square, and assuming that the model, the crystal field, energy scales are sufficiently large, clearly, you know, one has to go up to temperatures of order 5 Kelvin, really. Sorry, this is in Kelvin, in order to see this high temperature limit. One could also potentially try this Curie-Weiss type plot if one has data above 4 or 5 Kelvin, which I haven't seen, of 1 over C versus T square, and one gets a straight line over a wide temperature range. So this is a T square over here, so this is like 10 Kelvin. So one would need data at rather high temperature, which I have not seen. These methods could potentially lead to more than one, but I doubt that one can get four exchange constants, really. So how about data in a magnetic field, either single crystals or powder average, which one could do, presumably. Now, of course, one is faced with six exchange parameters. And we did do some calculations, although we did not, as one goes to high fields, as one might expect, you know, just the second order linked cluster method are actually very accurate. And these peaks are not entirely dominated by just the field term. I mean, so this is, say, for example, at 2 Tesla or 1 Tesla, you can see the single tetrahedra term is different from the final answer. One needs to at least go to up to 2 tetrahedra, not zero. Zero is one site, basically. So clearly there are exchange effects, but I don't know how discriminating they are and whether one can actually use this. There are also different field directions. I was just looking back at one plot that I had, and this is the data that Colin presented earlier about re-entrance in this transition of magnetic field. And along 111, the data at a very small field is cut off over here because it becomes too noisy. But if we go to, say, 0.5 Tesla, we start to see this somewhat convergent low temperature peak coming up, and perhaps we should look at it more carefully to see if we can say something. Okay, one could also, I mean, as you said, subtraction is an issue at these high temperatures, but one could also try subtracting one field value from another, and that can, of course, be done in the calculation. One could also look at the magnetization. Again, you know, if one is not at too low a temperature, then we did do these comparisons with the previous parameters, and they seem to work pretty well. So, anyway, I'm almost close to my end here over here. So, do we really need 6 parameters? Will be impossible in any case. Can machine learning actually help here? So, there's this very nice paper by Jim Settner and collaborators about sloppiness in emergent theory in theories in physics, biology, and beyond, which is really a practical scheme also for how to reduce the number of parameters based on data itself. So potentially, one can use the theoretical, how much variation there is in various, if we want to really go over all the magnetic field dependent properties, perhaps one can reduce the number of parameters that one needs to just a few that really are important in all the variations, really. So this could be an alternative to, we have seen parameter reduction by Nick and collaborators, and also by Radu, based on some theoretical ideas. But perhaps what I'm suggesting is that a data analysis-based approach could also be used to reduce the number of parameters. Okay. So with that, I'd like to also welcome everybody to the upcoming Highly Frustrated Magnetism meeting, which will be at the University of California at Davis. Next year. Thank you.
Thank you, Rishi. Question? Bruce? So I think I've asked you this in the past, but the work that you did with our original microscopic Hamiltonian, at the time that paper was written, you did compare it to other parameters, and they were...
Oh, yeah, those were way off, yeah. Right. But I believe Jeff has looked at the parameters that Radu has, and he finds agreement, but I haven't seen the comparison.
For the specific heat, it's a bit fuzzy because of sample and all of these kind of things, but it's not in any disagreement.
And also the Robert results? I was just wondering if that plot had been brought.
We should. I mean, I should have had, but yeah, I don't have the numerical data here.
Mostly about the kind of macroscopic properties such as susceptibilities and heat and so on. Is there a possibility of using methods like this to calculate our favorite dynamic correlation?
Well, so static ones one can. If you are interested in, say, neutron scattering spectra, not at very low temperatures, if you want to above, say, 1 Kelvin and higher, or maybe 2 Kelvin and higher, then you can get the static structure, the equal time correlation functions, or in principle, one can also do the zero frequency, which has not been done. That also can be done.
That brings in a bit more information.
Yeah, that is a lot more information, right, yeah. So, and Michelle's student did that. The static correlation function in the thermodynamic limit can be done.
Yeah, SFQ for
iterator. In principle, one can go and do the frequency moments I was talking about. But you know, then it's a much bigger scale computation. And so potentially, you know, if you think that one or two moments can provide you the information on where the spectral weight is at different Q, then that is also doable.
Because the instrumentation is now developing to the point that those can be quite
well. Yeah, so but temperature is the issue. If you want it at low temperatures, no, that will not work.
But for the purpose of determining exchange constants and so on, we just pick one's temperature.
Yeah, yeah.
I think maybe an important point, maybe in the design of experiments, right? I think that maybe the global message here is that there are high field and high temperature whenever possible to get hold of magnetization, receptor, and specific heat is an avenue to get a hint from these kind of calculations, right? From an experimental point of view, obviously you always want to dig to low temperature and look for interesting physics, but these are regimes for which we don't have control methods to flesh out the Hamiltonian in the quantum, strong quantum regime. Whereas as the diagram that Rajiv showed, right, high field, high temperature, there's a range of convergence when there's a bit of hole to get an idea of what the coupling parameters might be. But the everything you've shown, right, we went the forward route, right?
Right.
Estimates from measured couplings from Newton spectroscopy and show that after the fact,
right,
the thermodynamic was consistent. But whether or not this problem can be inverted is challenging.
I mean, you did mention this, but there's one advantage in that at least in zero field, you're not fitting the G ground.
Right. Yeah, zero field heat capacity is only exchange constants, yeah.
Another thing is for the non-Cramers ions, then there's one less parameter to deal with. For example, presenium zirconate, I think, or presenium aphthane, there might be some hope there to...
It might be worth having a database, really.
Yeah.
If one has a database of, let's say, in this three-parameter space, then presumably anybody... When they make a measurement, they can see what regions are consistent.
That sounds very exciting for samples that aren't available as single crystals, samples where you're...
Yeah.
Because in the ytterbium power floors, that broad anomaly can be as high as 5 Kelvin and as low as 1 Kelvin. So there's obviously, it's not really going to be that sensitive to the shape. There's a lot of detail. So would knowing the actual ground state of, the measured ground state of subtraction, would that help you to narrow down your parameter space?
Well, what do you mean by ground state?
The dipole order, the magnetic ground state.
Oh, the magnetic ground state. Well, that's not playing a role. That is beyond our calculations to get into that. But possibly one could use that as additional input. This is really not telling you anything about what happens at low temperatures and low fields.
Any other question? Comment? Okay, if not, let's thank Rajiv for an excellent talk.